Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The science is clear. The global climate and everything that depends on it are in big trouble. The Trump administration, on what to do about it? On the Paris Climate Accord, the biggest initiative to fight climate change? Not so clear right now. There's a fight inside the White House, a delay in deciding this week, the biggest possible stakes. This hour, On Point, the Paris Climate Accord and what the Trump administration plans to do about it. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Can you picture Donald Trump pulling the United States out of the Paris Climate Accord, as he threatened on the campaign trail? What then? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Later this hour, we go to the Hanford nuclear site in Washington State, where the U.S. Department of Energy has declared an emergency after a tunnel collapse. But first, to the Trump administration and the Paris Agreement. On the campaign trail, May last year, Bismarck, North Dakota, Donald Trump vowed to jettison the Paris Agreement.
We're going to cancel the Paris Climate Agreement and stop. Unbelievable. And stop all payments of the United States tax dollars to UN global warming programs.
That was a year ago, but not only a year ago. On his 100th day speech in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, April 29th, the president criticized the agreement again, saying it only benefits other countries, the Paris Agreement.
Our government rushed to join international agreements where the United States pays the costs and bears the burdens while other countries get the benefit and pay nothing. This includes deals like the one-sided Paris Climate Accord.
But you've got voices inside the White House and all around it. We're talking Ivanka Trump here, Jared Kushner, major Republicans from previous administrations, the president's own Secretary of State, former head of Exxon, Rex Tillerson. This was him in his Senate confirmation hearing earlier this year, saying the U.S. should stay in the Paris Climate Agreement to maintain its valuable position in climate negotiations.
I think having a seat at the table to address this issue on a global basis, and it is important. That I think it's 190 countries or thereabouts have signed on to begin to take action. I think we're better served by being at that table than leaving that table.
Better to be at the table, but will the United States be there when the Trump administration completes its consideration of the Paris Agreement? Joining us now from Washington is Coral Davenport. She covers energy and the environment policy for the New York Times. Coral, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, great to be with you, Tom.
There was supposed to be a big meeting this week that got postponed. What's going on around the decision process?
Well, this was one of President Trump's signature campaign promises, and there have been a lot of questions, sort of, when is he going to act? What is he going to do? It has emerged to the fore recently. The White House has planned meetings with kind of all of the principal advisors, Ivanka and Jared, Chief Strategist Steve Bannon, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, sort of all these key folks were supposed to get together on Tuesday and come up with some kind of consensus recommendation. The meeting was canceled in part because it became clear that there was no consensus possible. There's sort of two flanks within the White House, the kind of Steve Bannon flank that says, you know, yank out of Paris, keep that campaign promise to your base. You heard how the crowd cheered when he said that last year. And this other camp, Ivanka and Jared, the president's daughter and son-in-law, Secretary of State, a lot of foreign policy advisors saying this is a bad move. This could really have you know, broad ripple repercussion effects that would hurt the president's ability to carry out his foreign policy agenda far beyond the issue of climate. It shows the world that the U.S. does not keep its promise, weakens the negotiating hand on all kinds of other issues. That flank is saying stay in, maybe find a way to change the terms of what the U.S. will do, but kind of keep that seat at the table like Rex Tillerson promised. But there's no agreement. The two sides are absolutely at loggerheads. And so part of the reason this was sort of canceled and a decision is now postponed is it doesn't seem like they're any closer to a solution.
So this was Tuesday. Sean Spicer telling reporters at the Daily White House briefing that this is going to be delayed until after President Trump goes to the G7 summit in Italy later this month.
With regard to the Paris Climate Agreement, the president has been meeting with his team for quite a while on this matter, and he will not be making an announcement regarding that agreement until after he returns from the G7.
Why not? Here's more of Spicer.
The reason that he is seeking the advice of his team is to get options, and then he'll pursue the best one. But I'm not going to tell you which one that he's going to do. That's why he's continuing to meet with the team and to get advice. That's it, plain and simple.
Carl Davenport, can you remind us what the Paris Accord asked of its signatories, including the United States?
Sure. So the Paris Accord is the first ever universal global deal to fight climate change. It's 195 countries have signed on. All of those countries have pledged to take some kind of action to reduce their carbon emissions, to take actions to fight global warming. Under the terms of the agreement, every country submits a pledge or commitment laying out what domestic policies they will follow to lower their carbon emissions. Very importantly, those pledges, the terms of those pledges are voluntary. They're not legally binding. What is legally binding is that all the pledges have to be public. Every few years, every 5 years, the countries have to gather and show publicly what they're doing to meet those pledges. They have to come up with a system where every country demonstrates what its emissions are, kind of an apples to apples universal system that can be checked, verified, and confirmed. Those pieces are binding. What a country actually does to lower its emissions and how much money a country contributes to helping other countries lower emissions and adapt to climate change, those pieces are not legally binding. So the idea is it's designed to create this system of global political peer pressure where if you know you have to show your work, you'll feel compelled politically to take action. But there's no sanction or punishment if you don't actually follow through, other than the disapproval of your global peers.
The agreement overall aiming to hold global temperature rise below 2 degrees Celsius from pre-industrial levels. And this is to try and stave off the worst of rising seas and superstorms that climate models are predicting now. The United States under President Obama got in, agreed to this. To cut emissions, if I remember correctly, between 26, 27, 28% by 2025 from 2005 levels. Are those plans still on the board?
So the heart of the Obama administration's pledge was, as you said, 26 to 28% cut in emissions from 2005 levels by 2025. In order to do that, the Obama administration moved forward with a set of pretty ambitious, aggressive domestic regulations. The heart of those is a program called the Clean Power Plan, put forth by the EPA. It is designed essentially to shut down most coal-fired power plants in the U.S. They're the largest contributor to global warming emissions, as well as stringent new regulations on vehicle tailpipes. If those regulations are put forth and enforced and met, it would be possible for the U.S. to meet that pretty ambitious goal. President Trump has already declared that he wants to undo those regulations, roll them back. It's a big legal sort of heave to do that, but that's his stated agenda. If the U.S. does not implement those regulations, it's very hard to see how it could possibly meet the commitment. So the U.S. is already in a position where it's not likely under the Trump administration that it could possibly meet the targets, the numbers put forth by the Obama administration. So in one sense, the U.S. is already sort of backing away from its commitments on paper in the Paris Agreement.
What do critics, including the president, mean when he says that the agreement is one-sided or it disadvantages the United States or favors others? What's he mean by that?
I think that's a mischaracterization in that, as I said before, all of these pledges are voluntary. So different countries put forth different pledges. The Obama administration did put forth a pretty strong pledge, you know, up to 28% emissions cuts by 2025. That's ambitious. China, which is the world's largest polluter, put forth a pledge saying that its emissions would start to drop by or before 2030. So that's a concrete pledge. It's a different form of pledge than what the United States would do. Generally, developed countries put forward more aggressive or ambitious pledges than developing countries because their economies are further along. They're more equipped to do that. There's another portion of the agreement which calls on the rich developed countries to mobilize, as the word in the agreement, up to $100 billion annually by 2020 to help poor and developing countries adapt to the impacts of climate change. The expectation is that the U.S. and U.S. companies, U.S. business would be expected to pay more into that fund because it's the largest economy in the world and because it's the largest emitter. So I think that is what President Trump is talking about. Again, a way I've been putting it lately is there is an understanding that the U.S. as the largest historic emitter and largest economy should have larger obligations, but it's more kind of a noblesse oblige. It's an expectation, not a legal commitment.
Can the U.S. just – can Donald Trump just, I don't know, sign something or just say we're out and we're out? Is it that simple?
No. And it was designed to not be that simple, and it was also designed in part out of concern that – possibly president that candidate Donald Trump might win the U.S. election and do something like this. No, if a party wants to pull out, it can take up to 4 years to go through the whole legal process.
A battle on inside the White House now. The president headed to the G7 meeting in Italy later this month. Other world leaders sure to speak with him there about it, no doubt pressure him to stay in. The Paris Climate Accord, the biggest agreement ever to try and contain the worst effects of climate change. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the Paris Climate Accord and whether the Trump administration will try to take the U.S. out of it, out of the last best hope maybe to avert the worst of global climate change. There's been a lot of commentary from this administration, widespread reports of a deep split inside the White House, Steve Bannon saying, let's get out. We're talking about Scott Pruitt, head of the EPA, saying out. On the other side, we're told Ivanka Trump, Jared Kushner, Rex Tillerson himself, the Secretary of State, has said, let's stay in, have a seat at the table. And big figures from past administrations, George Shultz, who was Secretary of State during the Ronald Reagan years, saying stay in for his own set of reasons. Here was Pruitt. This was April 13th, interview with Fox and Friends, head of the EPA, Scott Pruitt, saying the U.S. should leave the Paris Climate Agreement.
Paris is something that we need to really look at closely because it's something we need to exit, in my opinion. It's a bad deal for America. It was an America's second, third, or fourth kind of approach. China and India had no obligations under the agreement until 2030. We front-loaded all of our costs.
What's your biggest objection to the Paris Agreement?
That America was put last.
America was put last. We'll look at that. China, Xi Jinping, leader there, addressing the UN in Geneva in January, said, China's in. China is respects this agreement, going to push hard with it for it.
The Paris Agreement is a milestone in the history of climate governance. We must ensure this endeavor is not derailed. All parties should work together to implement the Paris Agreement. China will continue to take steps to tackle climate change and fully honor its obligations.
China, big polluter now, the biggest. We were the biggest for a long, long time. China is saying it will hang in. The U.S., not so clear. Other countries watching very closely here. Very interesting, back in February, when he was a candidate, the now president of France, Emmanuel Macron, released a campaign video on his Facebook page with a message for American scientists discouraged by President Trump's actions on climate change.
Please, come to France. You are welcome. It's your nation. We like innovation. We want innovative people. We want people working on climate change, energy, renewables, and new technologies. France is your nation.
Scientists, climate scientists, come to France. Americans paying close attention to April 29th, 100th day of the Trump administration. Tens of thousands of demonstrators in the streets of Washington for a march against the Trump administration's environmental agenda.
We will not go away. Welcome to your 100th day.
We will not go away. But what will happen with the Paris Agreement, with U.S. participation? Coral Davenport is with us from the New York Times, covers environmental policy there. You can join us as well. What's the message this administration is sending out about the seriousness of climate change, about the seriousness of the U.S. in dealing with it? What do you make of the reported factions within the White House around the Paris Accord? Todd Stern joins us in just a moment, and Myron Ebel joins us before we finish this hour. He was big in advising the Trump administration during the transition period on climate. Lots of calls as well, though. Chantal in Detroit. Chantal, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to say was that it seems one thing people aren't noticing or focusing on is that I believe President Trump will pull out of the Paris Accord because he seems to be obsessed, if you say, with everything that President Obama did to undo it and to undermine it. So pulling out of the Paris Accord, I could see him doing it, and it's very concerning. I live here in Michigan. The Great Lakes were affected by, we see the climate change, we see global warming. We have the Great Lakes here with the EPA that's underfunded or defunded. We would be affected greatly. So all these changes are very concerning.
But you think the odds are he'll do it. He'll leave it.
I do. It's unfortunate, but I do. I mean, he's undoing the healthy child care plans that Michelle Obama put in place to make us less healthy. I mean, so I can see him destroying our environment also to, I don't know what, to undo everything, the benefits that have been done.
Chantal, I appreciate your call. Coral Davenport, please stand by there in Washington. I want to welcome into the conversation right now Todd Stern. He was U.S. Special Envoy for Climate Change in the Obama administration. This is from 2009 to 2016. Was chief negotiator for the U.S. and the Paris Climate Agreement. Todd Stern, thanks very much for being with us.
Tom, thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
You heard Scott Pruitt there saying that the United States put itself, I guess you put the United States, last in the way it negotiated this agreement. What do you say to that? Not second or third or fourth, but last.
No, look, Tom. I think that there's that's completely mistaken, and I think that that it's important to understand what we have going on here. There is no cost for the administration to stay in Paris. There's an enormous cost for the administration to pull out. First of all, as Coral has already described, this is an excellent agreement that covers everybody, that has nationally determined targets that nobody can force on a country, but they decide themselves. There's strong transparency. The targets are not binding. On the specific point that Mr. Pruitt made, it's just flat wrong. Most countries in this agreement, first of all countries are covered. China, India, everybody else have make their own pledges. Most countries put forward targets out to 2030. That was just their choice. We chose, the U.S. chose to do 2025 because we thought it was both better overall for climate purposes and better for us in our own circumstances.
Why better for us? He says China, India, no obligations until 2030. We front loaded all of our costs. That's his gripe here.
Yeah, but let me go mm-hmm. to the complete error in saying that China's got nothing to worry about until 2030. Let me give you China took a few different targets. Let me give you one example. They mm-hmm. took a target that said that they would reach 20% of their energy sources. They would get 20% of their energy sources from non-fossil sources, means renewable energy or nuclear, by 2030. That is an enormous pledge. That's going to require them to build something like 800 gigawatts of non-fossil by 2030. What does that mean? So that compares to an entire U.S. electricity system of about 1,100. It means that they would have to build in the order of over 100, the equivalent of 100 full-scale 500 megawatt power plants between now and 2030.
So it's a big commitment. It's a gigantic commitment.
That translates into about 100 of those, 100 such plants per year, two per week, every year till 2030, in order to meet that 20% pledge.
In other words, action now, or very soon, if not already.
And the notion that they don't have to do anything till 2030 is just poppycock. It's a complete misunderstanding.
Are we already out in effect, Todd Stern, with the measures that the president's taken by executive order to reverse some of the Obama administration executive orders, Clean Power Plan, and more?
I'm sorry.
Have the Trump steps already on environmental regulation effectively taken us out of our commitment? In effect,
No, I don't think so, Tom. First of all, so we have a previous commitment to reduce by around 17% by 2020. We're on pretty good track for that, and I think that we can. I think that we can get that. I think that if the president succeeds in rolling back policies that he's trying to roll back, obviously that's going to make it more difficult. I don't think it's going to make it impossible. I think you're going to see very active steps being taken by states, by cities. You're already seeing active steps by companies. I think it will be obviously much more difficult to reach our 26 and 28% target by 2025 if the president succeeds in rolling back these domestic policies. No doubt about that. But on the other hand, don't count the U.S. out in terms of strong action.
If the Trump administration does pull out, and that takes time and it's not easy, as Coral Davenport has pointed out, but if they say we're out, what would the ramifications be? What would the implications be for other nations' participation and for the global climate? Tuster.
Well, I think the ramifications would be very serious, and I don't want to leave this program without noting the tremendous support you see from the business community, and that's the Fortune 500 community.
We've seen these full page ads all over the place.
Yeah, all over the place. And that, Tom, let me tell you, I started on this issue in 1997, President Clinton. And this is a radically different picture than we had then. Back then, you had environmental groups, and maybe you had the solar energy guys and the wind guys who were supporting you. Now you have the biggest and most powerful and most important companies in the United States across the board urging that we stay in. So, look, what happens if we go out? First of all, I think that there is a huge diplomatic damage. It's something that that Condoleezza Rice has talked about recently. Something that
she implored Trump to stay in.
She did, and former Secretary of State Colin Powell also recalling the very powerful blowback that occurred even when President Bush took us out of Kyoto, and Kyoto was a very flawed agreement. What you have here is. Countries, 195 countries agreed to this deal. It took years and years of effort, of blood, sweat, and tears to get this done. Countries understand they care about climate change. They understand that you cannot solve a purely global problem like climate change without a global agreement. They understand you cannot have an effective global agreement without the United States. And they understand that this agreement was very significantly influenced by the United States and by United States ideas. So for the United States to turn around and say, never mind, it's a slap in the face. It's going to make countries very angry, and it's going to have diplomatic ramifications, which are exactly what Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice were talking about, with respect to equities of the United States way beyond climate change. So it would be a deeply foolish thing to do. And again, back on the business side, business wants to stay in this agreement because they know that climate change is real. They know that Paris was an historic agreement that's balanced, that can serve their needs as well as the needs of climate. They value predictability. They don't want to be in and out and in and out. And they know that this is a huge big opportunity in terms of the clean energy market that will be driven by the climate goals. So there's really no case. There is no case to be made for pulling the United States out.
We'll see. I want to bring in Get Out promoter Myron Ebell in just a second. But one more caller first. David in Asheville, North Carolina. David, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. First of all, I wouldn't trust China any farther than I could throw a school bus on any commitment that they say they're making. And I would also love it if the question were put out there to the public that says that they want to adhere to this agreement. Are you willing to do that if your energy costs are going to go up 30%? That is what would happen if you adhere to these commitments.
Oh, David, we got a rough line there, but let me pick those two things up, then I'll take it to Myron. Todd Stern, don't trust China, David says, and energy costs will go up 30% if we follow through.
Two things. First of all, there is broad transparency provisions that are included in this agreement. We're going to see what everybody does. Everybody's going to see what we do. That's part of the deal. Secondly, again, to reiterate, nobody's forced to take action they don't want to take. Countries make their own decisions about what they're going to do. And those targets are not legally binding.
Yeah, that's part of David's concern here. He's saying he doesn't trust China to follow through. If we pay the price and do it and they don't, he feels ripped off.
There's nothing that's going on in China right now that supports that view. China's is taking all sorts of very powerful measures. And again, there's going to be transparency. The other thing is the assumption that energy costs are going to be astronomically higher is way wrong. The costs of renewable energy have dropped absolutely dramatically in the last 8 years, 85% down for solar panels, 66% down for wind. In Texas, wind power is cheaper than fossil fuels. This is happening now in the United States. It's happening all over the world.
Todd Stern, stand by. I want to bring Myron Ebell in, if I may, director for the Center for Energy and the Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He led the EPA transition team for President Trump. That is a transition that ended up going towards Scott Pruitt, who says, get out. He joins us from Washington. Myron Ebell, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What do you think of the fight within the White House? What do you think the outcome will be over what to do here?
I think the fight within the White House is between the deplorables and the swamp, between the promise keepers and the promise breakers. I think that the White House would be ill-advised to listen to the advice of those people who support the Obama agenda on these things, like Todd Stern. I'm sure he was a very good advisor to President Obama, and he would have made a very good advisor to President Hillary Clinton. But he's promoting an agenda that is exactly the opposite of the one that President Trump ran on and was elected. And I would point out, this is the first election where climate policy was actually an issue, and the Republican candidate laid out a clear agenda, and so did the Democratic candidate. In 2008, President Obama didn't talk about it, but he immediately wanted cap and trade once legislation once he was elected.
What do you know
in
about
2012? He didn't talk about it, but as soon as he was reelected, he said, "Oh, this is the biggest problem in the world." Why didn't he mention that during the campaign?
Well, I mean, I do see polls of Americans. 70% of Americans are worried about the environment, want action taken. But President Trump was elected. That is quite true. How do you see the arguments being made within the White House right now? I mean, something a little more subtle than breakers versus keepers. What do you think the arguments are across the table there?
I think the argument is the promise breakers are saying we can stay in, but we can withdraw our commitment and submit a much less ambitious one. The commitment, the 26% to 28% commitment, the regulatory
reduction
actions,
by 2025.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the regulatory actions undertaken by the Obama administration would only get us about halfway there. President Trump wants to get rid of the biggest chunks of those regulations, so we're far below 50% in our goals. So the argument is, well, we can just make a very modest contribution and stay in. I think the problem with that is, first of all, it will subject the United States to constant global political pressure and browbeating. And second, something that hasn't been mentioned yet, this treaty commits the United States and every other party to make a new nationally determined contribution every 5 years that is more ambitious than the previous one. And this gets me to my final point. The treaty does not have language, contrary to what Todd Stern has said. The treaty has no language that suggests that you can withdraw your commitment and make a less ambitious one. It says you can withdraw your commitment if with an aim to making a more ambitious one.
Okay, we'll look at all of that. But aren't you worried about what happens to the climate if we and maybe others pull out?
No, this treaty will have no impact on global temperatures. By 2100, it will be 0.04 of a degree cooler if everybody keeps their promises and if the theories are correct.
We'll test that. My renewable standby. We're right up against the clock here. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking about the Paris Climate Accord and whether the Trump administration will try to take the U.S. out of it. Coral Davenport is with us, reporter for The New York Times. Todd Stern, U.S. Special Envoy for Climate Change in the Obama administration, chief negotiator for the U.S. of the Paris Climate Agreement, under threat now from the Trump administration. Myron Ebel is with us. He led the EPA transition team for President Trump, right in the heart of the group that says, no thanks, let's get out, let's drop it. You can join us. If the U.S. ducks the challenge here, where are we headed? What do you expect from the rest of the world? If the U.S. pulls out, what's it mean that the White House could pull out while even energy companies are stay in? Terry in Springfield, Illinois. Terry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm just calling in response to all the people who are worried about what, the politics of this and all of the concerns about what other countries might do. And I don't care. What I care about is the air I breathe and the air that my children will breathe and my grandchildren will breathe. I care about making our country the best place it can be. So renewable resources are the way to go. They are not going to hurt our environment. I don't even care if I have to pay a little more. I would love for the other countries to go along with this, and that's why I think the Paris Accord is a great thing. Ultimately, what they do may affect us, but we know our own actions will affect us, and we need to start with ourselves.
Terry, we got it loud and clear right there. Let me just hold that, if I may, and I appreciate your call. Christian in Lexington, Kentucky. Christian, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Just a couple of quick points. First of all, I think like many listeners, just shocked that you've got a tobacco lobbyist like Myron Ebel on the show. He's a complete climate change denier and dismisser. But let me get to my point.
He's here because he's advised the Trump administration in his transition, which is now in power, Christian. And so, here we are.
Here we are. So Dr. Prin, who's in charge of the climate change section over at MIT, pointed out not too long ago that the actual PPM
parts per million number, of CO2.
Yes, sir. Is not 400. It's not 410. That number was actually passed in 1985. The actual number is much closer to 500. And, we're talking in the foreseeable future. And Myron Ebel can't talk about this because he's not a scientist. He's a tobacco lobbyist.
What are you worried about here, Christian? What are you worried about?
Okay, well, the pollution, the acidification of ocean waters, on and on and on. I mean, if you watch Inconvenient Truth and the new movie coming out by Al Gore, he paints it much more eloquently.
Why do you think the president may go down this path? What do you think is driving him then?
Well, this president is a pay-to-play mafia leech owned by the likes of Murray Cole and ExxonMobil's Rex Tillerson, who are either outright climate change deniers or climate change dismissers.
Christian, we've got it. Our time is short, but we've got it. I mean, Rex Tillerson's in there saying stay in, so I'm not sure. Todd Stern, I want to come first to you because Myron Ebel put some stuff on the table here saying, look, this is not going to get us out of this pickle. This agreement won't work anyway. You heard his argument. What do you say?
Well, obviously, I disagree with it. I think that, first of all, the notion that that this agreement is going to reduce our temperature by whatever he said, 0.04 of a degree by the end of the century, mm-hmm. is ridiculous. I mean, the purpose of this agreement, and it's something else he alluded to, is to have the actions of countries ratchet up over time. That is indeed why we built into the agreement that every 5 years countries would review their targets, with certainly encouragement to increase and go upward. But very importantly, encouragement, not a requirement. And contrary to what Myron said, there is no bar to a country deciding that they need to go to adjust down. And there's a very good reason for that. I mean, that's not an accident. We negotiated that. We negotiated it because we thought that if there was a legal bar for a country to go down, it would lead countries to lowball the targets they were putting forward in the first place out of fear that they could get stuck. And we indeed saw a situation just a few years before the negotiation in Paris, this back in 2011, where Japan went through the Fukushima disaster.
Yep.
They had a 2020 target that had – this is not Paris. This is before Paris, yep. A 2020 target set after Copenhagen. And the Japanese felt that they needed to adjust their target downward. Circumstances had arisen that led them to that view.
So maybe Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner, if Myron's right, they're saying, well, just stay in it, but, you know, take our – measures down, dial back what we're...
I think, Tom, that's exactly the discussion that is going on in the White House. And by the way, I don't want to be misunderstood. I do not like at all, not even a little bit, the notion that the United States would adjust down. I don't think we need to. I think it's exactly the wrong message. But is it permitted under Paris? Yes. And it's permitted for the reason that I just said. And the discussion in the White House, as I understand it right now, is between those who say out altogether and those who say let's stay in, but let's review our target. And clearly, if those are the only two options, the option that we all need and that the business community wants and the military community wants and the leaders all over the world want is that – yes, we stay in, and that's an enormously important thing.
If I may, Coral, you've been patiently waiting. If the U.S. stays in, if that's what the argument is in the White House, like totally get out or stay in, but in effect, pull down our targets so that we're not hitting them anyway, is it tantamount to the same thing, Coral, as getting out?
No, I don't think so. It certainly the rest of the world would look at those two options at different ends of the same scale. If the U.S. Pulls out entirely, does not have a seat at the table, is not part of the global discussion on global warming at all, the diplomatic damage that does to the U.S. standing, the way it is perceived by the rest of the world, has been described as devastating. You know, the rest of the world, it wouldn't just be kind of a slap on the wrist and a frown. It would be the U.S. is not even taking the problem of climate change seriously, and it's not part of the discussion. And why should we take the U.S. seriously on matters ranging from trade to military force to manage ISIS? If the U.S. stays at the table and changes what it's going to do, certainly that will be frowned upon. I think the rest of the world will say, well, you know, we don't like seeing the U.S. Not being a leader on this, not being ambitious. But the rest of the world also knows that at some point there will be a different administration, maybe in 2020, maybe in 2024. But the architecture of this agreement is designed to last and be implemented and evolve over many decades.
Yep.
So the architects of the deal say, okay, you know, maybe this administration revises the targets down, and then the next, but continues to go to the meetings, continues to play a role, and you know, either after 2020 or 2024, next administration comes in, and you may, you know, the U.S. is still there, and there's an opportunity to tweak the numbers.
Coral, we've got it. Myron Ebel, you're more wired into this than anybody else here. How do you think it's going to go? The debate in the home stretch when the president comes back from the G7 meeting. Which way do you think the Trump administration will go?
First, Tom, let me reply to your caller who kept repeating that I was a tobacco lobbyist. This is kind of the the falsehoods and the lies spread by the environmental movement to try to discredit their opponents. I have never been a tobacco lobbyist, an anti-tobacco lobbyist. I've never taken a position on any of these issues.
All right, we got falsehoods and lies on all sides here, maybe sometimes.
No, no.
Can we go to the main point here?
This is a one-way street, Tom. I don't lie about my opponents. Now, the second thing I would say about this agreement is I think Coral's got it right that it's the architecture is permanent. So every 5 years, every country has to submit a new
And that's deliberate because, as you say, we're not on track right now to really confront the scale of the defined challenge.
Right. That's why I think the president will decide to withdraw completely. I think he wants to show real leadership in the right direction, not in the wrong direction. He wants to turn the economy around.
Do you have to be a climate change denier to be comfortable with that?
No, and I'm not a climate change denier. That's another one of these.
No, I'm just asking if one has to be comfortable with leaving the
Paris Accord. Not at all. Not at all. I think, look, the president wants to get us back to 3% per annum economic growth. California is not the model. This idea that electric rates and energy prices are not going to go up is false. California is way ahead of the rest of the country in implementing these policies. Their electric rates are twice the national average. Germany, which is even further ahead, is three times our electric rates. People are suffering because of high electric rates in these countries that have undertaken these policies.
And yet, they're moving forward. The United States, not so clear. And the challenge here and the stakes, very, very high indeed. I want to thank all three of you for being with us. Myron Ebel, Todd Stern, Coral Davenport of the New York Times. Thank you to each of you. In a moment, we go to the nation's most contaminated nuclear site, where a tunnel collapsed and an emergency was declared on Tuesday. This is On Point. Early Tuesday, an emergency alert went out at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in southeastern Washington state. It is the nation's most contaminated nuclear site. They're now dumping truckloads of earth into a huge sinkhole as fast as they can to deal with it. Joining me now from with the latest from nearby Richland, Washington, just a little over 20 miles from where the accident happened, is Anna King, correspondent for the Northwest News Network. Anna King, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What is the history of this site?
The history of Hanford is it's a war horse for World War II and Cold War operations for the United States. Here was where all the plutonium for bombs was produced. And so like a French battlefield might be littered with cannons and dead horses, here it's littered with radioactive waste and old buildings and factories and the leftovers of this great war that we were fighting. And so it's a big cleanup site. There's many, many things that have to be cleaned up out here. Everything from 56 million gallons of radioactive sludge in house-sized tanks underground that are aging and you know leaking to lab coats, beakers, barrels underneath the desert soil.
So I mean, and this is an area where the nearby town is all about this period. They've got the bombers drive through. The Richland High School mascot is the bomber. On the gym floor, they've got a mushroom cloud painted. There's the atomic bowl, atomic foods, atomic auto body, atomic scuba. This was Atom City, and so much came in here. What happened? What was in this tunnel, and what happened, Anna?
Yes, in fact, I actually live in a Hanford house, which is one of the original prefab houses that was built in the country to support this war effort. But here, when the tunnel collapsed about 8:30 a.m. on Tuesday morning, a big sinkhole was created in this underground railroad tunnel. It was about a 100-foot area. 9,000 workers across Hanford were told to shelter in place, and then many were sent home right away, and then later on, more were sent home. It was a big disruption to work out here. It took 53 truckloads of dirt to fill that hole. That just got completed early in the wee hours of last night. Workers are back to normal today, coming back to work, starting up again. But it's been a big disruption.
What was so dangerous down there, Anna? Why was it this full-on emergency when a hole opened up?
Exactly. So this tunnel was connected or near a big plant called the Purex plant. Now, that was a plant that concentrated plutonium out of metal rods that were irradiated at a nuclear reactor. And so it was a big chemical process. We call these buildings Queen Marys because they look like massive ships on the desert. And these tunnels were used to kind of take away the old equipment. So as they would do these chemical processes with acids and other corrosive liquids, they would, you know, kind of wear out these metal parts in the plant, and they had to be carried away. And of course, they were contaminated with radioactive waste, so they would wheel them into these or place them into these train cars and wheel them under the ground to shield them from workers. And that's what's in those tunnels.
The plutonium produced at Hanford filled the Fat Man nuclear bomb. That's the one that was dropped over Nagasaki, Japan, killed tens of thousands of people. Has the if they didn't close the hole, what would the risk be to the workers there and the surrounding community?
So one of the biggest risks with plutonium contamination is that you would breathe it in and get it inside your body. So they're really sensitive. They don't want any dust flying up or any plutonium particles getting into the air. The other problem is just radioactive dose that could come off of many different constituents on these radioactive, pot metal kind of pieces of equipment that are under the ground. And so they want to shield that with dirt to, keep the dose down from any workers. And they took it very, very seriously. Even workers miles and miles away from this incident were not allowed to work because they wanted to make sure everything was safe.
We're spending $6 billion a year on cleaning this up. Are we close to cleaning up Hanford, or is it still a open or closed sore of nuclear threat now?
It is a very complex site, Tom. This is bad. I'm not trying to downplay what has happened with this train car, but on the scale of waste at Hanford, it's not that big of a deal. We have, like I said, 56 million gallons of radioactive waste in these house-sized underground tanks. Millions, more than a million gallons of this waste has leaked into the ground. It's highly radioactive. We also have, huge plumes of groundwater under the site carrying things like hexavalent chromium. That's the stuff that Aaron Brockovich worked on, and other radionuclides towards the Columbia River. We also have a huge building out here that's in demolition now called the plutonium finishing plant that's very contaminated with plutonium. So these are some of the issues and challenges out here. That's the big stuff. Now we have a lot of aging infrastructure like these tunnels that are also causing problems. And just a by way of note, if you've never been out here, it's centered in this spectacular natural area. We are surrounded by the Hanford Reach National Monument, which Clinton designated, which is under review by the Trump administration now. It's an amazing place. The Columbia River runs right past the Hanford site, and there's Rattlesnake Mountain flanking us on the other side. This is a home to many rare desert plants.
All that opening up this week to the world with a hole revealing just how much poison lies beneath and the huge challenge of dealing with it. Anna King with Northwest News Network, thank you very much for giving us some insight there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.